Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. We come to you 7 days a week from the Voice of America in Washington. Today, we want to tell you about an American doctor who spends a lot of time in Africa helping young people who have heart problems. Then, the story of motorcycle gangs, or clubs, as some like to be known. In the movies, they are almost always the bad guys who fight each other and break laws. What's the real story? Stay with us and find out. It's time to listen and learn with VOA. Thousands of children in developing nations are born with heart problems. Thousands more develop heart disease when they are young. American Craig Sable helps some of these boys and girls. He is a pediatric cardiologist, a doctor who treats children with heart problems. Bob Doty tells us about Dr. Sable.
For more than 10 years, he has been traveling to Uganda to give young people in the East African nation the medical care they need.
I think the most striking thing to me is when I walk into the waiting room and see 50 to 100 children who I know if they were here, they would get fixed, and I know that we have a chance to help them.
Dr. Sable chooses the children who need help, and then works with other doctors before, during, and after the treatment. In some cases, Ugandan and American doctors work together on surgical operations. Sometimes, the Ugandan doctors perform the surgery themselves, with the Americans providing support. Dr. Sable works with medical charity groups. He has performed about 500 open-heart surgeries on Ugandan children. About 95% of the operations are successful. He notes that this success rate is almost as high as the rate in the United States.
When I first went in 2002, there was no hope. Now we're treating about a third to half that we see. That's still way too few. But when you look in the children's eyes and the parents' eyes, you just know there's an opportunity to make a difference.
Dr. Sable's presence gives Ugandans hope that their children will be healed.
Yeah, and he has a very large hole in the, between the bottom two chambers of the heart, which causes extra blood to go to the lungs and makes the heart work harder and takes away productive circulation from the body.
I'm just pleading. It is not easy.
They'll wait 10 hours, 3 days, take a bus for 20 hours, because they know that us being there means their child can live a normal life versus die at a young age. And with that tremendous expectation, we've really got to do everything we can to try to close the gap and allow these kids to get the care they deserve.
Dr. Sable performed his first open-heart surgery in Uganda in 2007. Almost all of the surgeries he performs are on children born with birth defects. They might have problems such as holes in the heart, blocked arteries, or leaky valves. He partners with the Ugandan Heart Institute at the Mulago National Referral Hospital in Kampala. Dr. Sable says Uganda has what he calls a wonderful cardiology team. He says Uganda is one of only 3 African countries south of the Sahara where open-heart surgeries can be performed entirely by local doctors. The other 2 are Ghana and Kenya. Twalib Aliku is a Ugandan cardiologist. He says he has learned a lot from Dr. Sable.
He loves children and getting these children who otherwise will not have access to life-saving surgery. I mean, it's a noble cause, and it's very, from the children's perspective, it's like someone helping you live a new life. And I think it's been very wonderful for him to come to do that in our country. Basically, he started the program when we couldn't do any surgeries on our own, and we've reached this point where we are doing many surgeries on our own as a country. It's just tremendous what is done.
Dr. Sable says he will continue to work with the Ugandan medical community to help sick children. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Some law enforcement officials in the United States say motorcycle clubs are criminal gangs. Investigators were especially critical of such clubs after a shooting in May in the southwestern city of Waco, Texas. Several groups of motorcyclists had gathered at a restaurant. There was a dispute, and members of competing clubs began shooting at each other. 9 people were killed and 18 others wounded. But motorcyclists say they are not criminals and should not be treated as lawbreakers. Some of them note that they have been meeting for years without being charged with a crime. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
Our story begins at the Hog Stop Restaurant and Bar in Houston, Texas. A few hundred members of motorcycle clubs from the Houston area went there recently for food and drinks. Police had said they would watch the situation closely, yet there was no sign of police officers there, and the gathering appeared peaceful. Lawyer Joey Lester has represented motorcycle clubs from across the country. He says almost every time motorcyclists meet, the gathering is a peaceful event.
We have had 8 or 9,000 of them over the last 30 years. We've never had any problems, even little problems, between the clubs at any of these meetings. That thing in Waco was an aberration.
Mr. Lester says it appears police overreacted when they arrested 170 people at the gathering in Waco. Police charged those they arrested with criminal conspiracy.
Are you supposed to have evidence against each person of that particular thing to bring a charge like that against them? So what they did, what the law enforcement did there, was a travesty of justice, in my opinion.
Some legal experts say police were justified in making mass arrests, given the disorder at the time of the shootings. Many of those arrested were released after appearing in court. They made a bond payment and promised to return when a trial date is set. At the meeting in Houston, and at a recent large gathering in Austin, Texas, there were no signs of tension between motorcycle groups. Tracy White is a member of a biker club. She says the clubs welcome everyone.
We don't go by your race, we don't go by your age, none of that matters. Everything is transparent. Love is love.
The meetings are well organized and follow rules. Prayer is also part of the meetings. Reverend Rocky Summerfield operates a group called We Will Ride Ministries.
Some of these guys, they don't feel comfortable with a church setting. So this is our mission field.
A member of the Wild Dillos Club named Slick says he works at a bank during the week.
Wearing a coat and tie, yeah, and on the weekends I like to put my jeans on and my jacket and my vest and ride my Harley.
Clubs say some of their members include lawyers, doctors, and bankers. Other members have low-paying jobs. Some bikers belong to clubs with a rough reputation. They almost always wear black leather clothing. Their appearance might be frightening to an outsider. It is difficult to know, just by looking at them, which members are criminals and which are not. Reverend Summerfield says most club members obey the law, love their country, and pay their taxes.
No different than a ladies' tennis club. You know, they have an interest in playing tennis and whatever. We just have a big interest in camaraderie and riding motorcycles.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. The first year of college is usually a time to learn and have fun. Many young people enjoy the freedom of living away from home for the first time. For young women in the United States, however, it is a time when they are at a high risk of experiencing a sex crime. The U.S. Justice Department reports that American women age 18 to 24 had the highest rate of sexual assault. The study also found that university students were less likely to report such crimes than non-students. Among college women, 9 out of 10 knew the person who sexually assaulted them. In Canada, 3 universities recently ran a program to train female students to avoid sexual assault while in college. The 2-year program was available at universities in Calgary, Alberta, and Windsor and Guelph in Ontario, Canada. The program involved women in their first year at the schools. The students spent 12 hours learning how to judge risks, deal with emotions, and use self-defense. The program taught students to be especially on guard at parties and other high-risk campus social events. The training taught students to attend such events together. If separated, they should check on each other periodically. They should also take extra care in their use of alcohol. At least half of the sexual assaults among college women involve drinking. About 450 students received the training. A group of about the same size received only written information and a brief meeting with the trainers. The group that received the 12 hours of training saw an almost 50% drop in risk of rape. Study investigators said there were limitations in their research. They noted that the study was designed for women. They wrote that effective interventions that target men's behavior are also needed. In the U.S., Harvard, Rutgers, and several other universities have also developed bystander training. This means students offer help if they see someone in danger of being assaulted. The training helps students, both men and women, decide when it is safe to personally intervene and when to call the police. Last year, President Barack Obama ordered the establishment of a task force on sexual violence at universities. The investigative group's report advised universities to take several measures. They include methods for researching the sex crime climate of the university and improving systems for reporting crimes, as well as prevention programs. The White House task force said 1 in 5 women experiences sexual assault in her college years. It has started a website called Not Alone to give schools and students information on how to react to and prevent sexual assault. Schools or educators can learn more about preventing sexual violence from the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. I'm Jill Robbins. Thank you.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Soon after his presidency began, there was an attempt on his life. A gunman shot President Reagan in March 1981. Doctors removed the bullet. He rested, regained his strength, and returned to the White House in 12 days. The new president wanted to reduce the size of the federal government. He and other conservative Republicans wanted less government interference in the lives of Americans. President Reagan won congressional approval for his plan to reduce income tax rates. Many Americans welcomed the plan. Others were concerned about its effects on the national debt. They saw taxes go down while defense spending went up. To save money, the Reagan administration decided to cut spending for some social programs. This pleased conservatives. Liberals, however, said it limited poor people's chances for good housing, health care, and education. President Reagan also had to make decisions about using military force in other countries. In 1983, he sent Marines to Lebanon. They joined other peacekeeping troops to help stop fighting among competing groups. On October 23rd, a truck carrying explosives bombed Marine housing at Beirut International Airport.
There was nothing in its appearance to suggest it was any different than the trucks or cars that were normally seen on and around the airport. But this one was different. At the wheel was a young man on a suicide mission. The truck carried some 2,000 pounds of explosives. But there was no way our Marine guards could know this. Their first warning that something was wrong came when the truck crashed through a series of barriers. The guards opened fire, but it was too late. The truck smashed through the doors of the headquarters building in which our Marines were sleeping and instantly exploded.
241 Americans were killed. Two days later, Marines led an invasion of the Caribbean island nation of Grenada. Communist forces were rebelling against the government there. Cuban soldiers were guarding the streets. President Reagan said he feared for the safety of American students at a medical school in Grenada. He sent the Marines to get them out safely. The Marines quickly defeated the communist forces. Many Americans were pleased. Others were angry. They said Grenada was invaded only to make people forget about what happened in Lebanon. The next year, 1984, was a presidential election year. It looked like no one could stop President Reagan. His warm way with people had made him hugely popular. He gained support with the military victory in Grenada. And by the time the campaign started, inflation was under control. The Republican Party renominated Ronald Reagan for president and George Bush for vice president. There were several candidates for the Democratic Party's nomination. One was the first African American to seek the presidency, Jesse Jackson. He was a Protestant clergyman and a longtime human rights activist. The candidate who finally won the nomination was Walter Mondale. He had been a senator and had served as vice president under President Jimmy Carter. The vice presidential candidate was Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro. It was the first time a major party in the United States had nominated a woman for national office.
Tonight, the daughter of working Americans tells all Americans that the future is within our reach if we're willing to reach for it. Tonight, the daughter of an immigrant from Italy has been chosen to run for president in the new land my father came to love.
One issue in the election campaign was taxes. Political candidates often try to avoid talking about taxes with voters. But former Vice President Mondale did talk about the issue. He said taxes would have to be raised to pay for new government programs.
The American people will have to pay Mr. Reagan's bills. The budget will be squeezed. Taxes will go up. And anyone who says they won't is not telling the truth to the American people.
This was a serious political mistake. President Reagan gained even more support as a result. The two candidates agreed to debate on television. During one debate, President Reagan looked old and tired. He did not seem sure of his answers. Yet his popularity was not damaged. On Election Day, he won 59% of the popular vote. On Inauguration Day, the weather was bitterly cold in Washington. All inaugural activities, including the swearing-in ceremony, were held inside. President Reagan's first term began with an attempt on his life. 6 months after his second term began, he faced another threat. Doctors discovered and removed a large growth from his colon. The growth was cancerous. The president was 74 years old. Yet once again, he quickly regained his strength and returned to work. For years, the United States had accused Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi of supporting international terrorist groups. It said he provided them with weapons and a safe place for their headquarters. In January 1986, the United States announced economic actions against Libya. Then it began military training exercises near the Libyan coast. Libya said the Americans were violating its territory and fired missiles at them. The Americans fired back, sinking two ships. On April 5th, a bomb destroyed a dance club in West Berlin. An American soldier and another person were killed. The United States said Libya was responsible. President Reagan ordered a bombing raid on the Libyan cities of Tripoli and Benghazi. Muammar Gaddafi escaped unharmed, but said his adopted daughter was killed. Some Americans said the raid was cruel. Others praised it. President Reagan said the United States did what it had to do. The president also wanted to intervene in Nicaragua. About 15,000 rebel troops, called Contras, were fighting the country's communist government. President Reagan asked for military aid for the Contras. Congress rejected the request. In fact, it banned all aid to the Contras. At that same time, Muslim extremists in Lebanon seized several Americans. The Reagan administration looked for ways to gain the release of the hostages. It decided to sell missiles and missile parts to Iran in exchange for Iran's help. After the sale, Iran told the extremists in Lebanon to release a few American hostages. Not long after, serious charges became public. Reports said that money from the sale of arms to Iran was used to aid the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Several members of the Reagan administration resigned. It appeared that some had violated the law. President Reagan said he regretted what had happened, but he said he had not known about it. Investigations and court trials of those involved continued into the 1990s. Several people were found guilty of illegal activities or of lying to Congress. No one went to jail. Most Americans did not blame the president for the actions of others in his administration. They still supported him and his policies. They especially supported his efforts to deal with the Soviet Union. At the beginning of his first term, President Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire. To protect the United States against the Soviets, he increased military spending to the highest level in American history. Then, in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. Reagan and Gorbachev held four summit meetings in Geneva, Switzerland, Reykjavik, Iceland, Washington, and Moscow. Each leader agreed to destroy hundreds of nuclear missiles. President Reagan also urged General Secretary Gorbachev to become more democratic. He spoke about the Berlin Wall, which communists had built to prevent citizens from crossing between East and West Berlin.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
About this time, a new sense of glasnost, or openness, was beginning in the Soviet Union. It was also a time of perestroika, or restructuring. The American economy grew rapidly during Ronald Reagan's presidency, but at the end of his second term, many Americans were concerned by what he left behind. Increased military spending, together with tax cuts, had made the national debt huge. The United States owed thousands of millions of dollars. The debt would be a political issue for presidents to come. Yet Ronald Reagan will be remembered as one of America's most popular presidents. Above his burial place at the Reagan Library in California are these words which speak to Reagan's belief in humanity. I know in my heart that man is good, that what is right will always eventually triumph, that there is purpose and worth to each and every life. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Thank you.